for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Glenn Hubbard says narrow-minded American politicians have created a middle-class entitlement state. In a new book, the former chair of the Council of Economic Advisers under President George W. Bush says we must lower our debt. He says we should begin by rolling back federal benefits for wealthier and middle-class Americans. His book is titled Balance: The Economics of Great Powers from Ancient Rome to Modern America. Glenn Hubbard joins me from a studio at Columbia University to talk about how the U.S. can avoid being the next great power to fall. Throughout the hour, we'll welcome your questions and comments. Join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you, sir. Good to have you with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
You have written a book that really looks back at great powers of the past and their decline. As you look at civilizations from Rome to the Ming Dynasty and even to the state of California, how do you connect all of that to what's happening now?
Well, the book is actually a very optimistic book, even though it talks about decline. The U.S. really is the dominant economic power and is likely to remain so if we continue to get our act together. Great powers stumble when their politics don't keep up with economics, when they turn inward, when they ignore the future. Those mistakes have been made many times in history, but America can definitely avoid that trap.
What mistakes do you see the U.S. making now that could perhaps lead us down that destructive path?
Well, the easiest manifestation of our mistake is the continuing buildup of debt, and even more problematic, the debt growth in the future that really threatens to rob us of the ability for government to do big things, to defend our nation, to educate our children, to conduct basic research, tax burdens that could crowd out American growth. Underneath that is a politics of polarization that has made all this possible. We can change the politics, we can change budget rules, and we can avoid this trap.
You're talking a great deal about entitlement spending. Tell me why you believe that particular area of the budget could lead to a downturn.
Well, first, to paraphrase Willie Sutton, it's where the money is,
yeah,
and where the
course.
Money will be. It really dominates the budget. But more to the political theme of the book, it's in a very non-transparent budget issue for the American people. It's not really on the budget. The Congress isn't responsible year to year. So we have a system in which entitlements are allowed to grow and threaten the ability of government to do many other things. There are ways to increase transparency for entitlements. To give an example, years ago when the Congressional Budget Office started, that was an amazingly important institution for transparency. America needs another shot.
Another shot? What do you mean?
Well, we need to think about changing the rules a bit. We use the example, Tim Kaine, my co-author, and I use the example in the book of basketball, which is a sport that nearly died until the three-point shot. And America needs a three-point shot. And the three-point shot is probably a change in our politics to allow more political competition of ideas and a change in budget rules to make the entitlement programs transparent so the American people really understand the gravity of the situation.
Okay, let's take the first of those two, a change in politics. What do you mean?
Well, if you look at the period from the early 1970s until relatively recently, we basically gave the two political parties, the Democrat and Republican Party, almost a monopoly over fundraising. And at the same time, the Congress became much more polarized. And that's not a purely Democrat problem or a purely Republican problem. It's both. The idea to fix this is to allow more political competition. And frankly, the Citizens United decision is a breath of fresh air in that regard,
because
it increases the ability to compete with the two parties. The optimal number of parties in the U.S. is two, but it doesn't have to be these two. Over time, the U.S. has evolved in its partisan structure. The Republican Party itself grew up as a party of radical abolitionism to challenge the status quo. We need to let ideas that could change America come forth, and the politics is going to be important, and getting new ideas out there will be very important.
And what about entitlements? How do you see them becoming such a central part of the problem?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at the budget over time and turn back a few decades, you'd see the government that Americans actually think government is. It defends the country, pays for some education, and so on. As the decades have gone on, much more of the budget goes into spending in Social Security, in Medicare, and other entitlement programs that aren't on the budget. What we argue in the book is we need to increase transparency by putting these things on the budget. And in the limit, if we can't solve this in our political process, literally have a spending limitation in the Constitution,
but
where spending is limited to a moving average of past revenue.
But, Glenn Hubbard, what about two wars off budget?
Also a problem. But we kid ourselves if we think our long-term budget problems are about military adventure. This was really the fallacy of Rome as well, that Rome's fault was overstretched. Indeed, as an economist looking at Rome, Rome's death was more understretched than overstretched. It was looking inward. It was rent-seeking. Military spending may be too high. I'm not an expert on the military, but it's not where the money is.
At the same time, when you talk about deficits and deficit spending and the lack of transparency, what happened during the George W. Bush administration in which you served? Didn't deficits go higher and higher after Mr. Bush inherited a surplus?
They definitely did. Some of it for reasons not the president's fault, a weaker economy, but some, frankly, the president contributed to. The problem we have in the budget in the country is not a Democrat problem, and it is not a Republican problem. We've had both sides of the aisle complicit in a system that has allowed debt to grow and has avoided making hard choices for the American people. The expansion of Medicare Part D under President Bush's watch was another example of a budget overreach that increased deficits and debt. There's no question about it. This is a bipartisan problem. If we're going to fix it, we have to come together.
And coming together is something that even Republicans are having a tough time doing, as you have seen in this current lack of budget negotiations, and that lack led by Tea Party conservatives.
Well, we really have to decide as a country, what is it that we want? The first big question is, how big should government be and what should it do? Once we've answered that question, we can then talk about the taxes that pay for it. And I think we need to have a debate over the size and the scope of government. But where I disagree with many on the right is the notion that we don't have to pay for the government we have. We absolutely do. If we make a decision that we want a government of a certain size, we have to pay for it. That's what transparency is about.
Glenn Hubbard is dean of Columbia University's Graduate School of Business. He's former chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisors under George W. Bush with Tim Kaine. He's written a new book. It's titled Balance, The Economics of Great Powers from Ancient Rome to Modern America. And if you'd like to join us, call us on 800-433-8850. We talk about the cost of war, $2.2 trillion, the estimate for two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which certainly set us on a road leading to big problems. How do you amend that? How do you erase that from the situation in which we find ourselves now?
Well, I think it begins with a conversation with all the American people about what do we want government to do in normal times. And I think most people would say, well, you need a reasonable defense budget. We need to make sure that we can educate our children. We make sure that we can do basic research and support the nation's infrastructure. We need a budget that's right-sized to that. And to that, I would add, we need a strong social safety net. So if we add those things together, that gives us a size of government. And then we have to be honest with the American people about what it's going to take to pay for that. Well, and we shouldn't kid ourselves that wars are free or entitlement programs are free, because they're not.
If you talk about social safety nets, aren't you talking about a growing sector of the public who is going to need that social safety net, and therefore that safety net has got to expand?
Well, I don't quite accept that, but let me go at what I mean by a social safety net. I mean taking care in a more muscular way the least well-off among us. That is very different from a cradle-to-grave entitlement state that treats everybody the same. If we want to right-size entitlements, we really need to make sure that we reduce the growth of benefits for affluent people and focus our support on the least well-off among us. We can afford that and do all the other things we need to do. But you're right. If we choose an alternative path, we need to pay for it.
Glenn Hubbard, his new book is titled Balance: The Economics of Great Powers from Ancient Rome to Modern America. When we come back, we'll talk further, open the phones, read your email. I look forward to speaking with you. And if you've just joined us, Glenn Hubbard is with me. He's joining us from Columbia University, where he is dean of the Graduate School of Business. He's also the author of a brand new book. It's titled Balance: The Economics of Great Powers from Ancient Rome to Modern America. We are going to open the phone shortly, but first I want to ask you more about these entitlement programs, which you say are present from the cradle to the grave. Of course, not everyone receives entitlement programs, but you say they're on autopilot. What do you mean?
Well, this gets back to the transparency point. Social Security and Medicare are not part of the federal budget, even though they're increasingly dominating federal spending. They are simply on autopilot in terms of eligibility and growth over time. They're set by formula. An alternative would be to say to the Congress, you know, every year, changes in the liabilities of these programs will go on the budget, and you, the Congress, will have to decide to raise taxes to pay for that, or cut some other spending, or change these programs. In other words, make the choices that households and businesses have to make. Unless and until we get that kind of transparency, it's hard for Americans to understand the fiscal mess we're in.
Are you in favor of raising taxes right now?
I don't think this is a good time to raise taxes.
Why not?
But I think this, well, because the economy is still in a nascent recovery, and we just had a very large tax increase. I do think, though, that we have to think about a tax increase if people want the size of government that's built into current budgets. I personally don't. But if that's what the majority of Americans want, we have to be honest with the American people about how much taxes will have to go up and how much on every individual to make it happen. Absolutely, we have to have that conversation.
I wonder whether you think that the political issues out there are going to be resolved, or if you happen to hear our last hour's program, whether politically there is no resolution, that Tea Party members are absolutely resolute in their thinking that there should be no compromise.
Well, I think it was Winston Churchill who said the American people do the right thing. After all, other options are exhausted. I am very optimistic about this country's ability to get out of its fiscal mess. But our current political system, our current budget rules are absolutely not structured for it. We are designed for a world in which budgets are all about war and peace. That is not the budget world we live in today. So, yes, we have to make some changes, but we can do this.
How?
Well, again, it's bound to two things. It's politics and rules. On the politics, we need to allow much freer competition of ideas. For example, I don't agree with much of what folks in the Tea Party advocate, but I have to say I'm happy to see those ideas. I'm happy to see new ideas on the left as well. We need a free flow of ideas and not two monopoly parties telling us what to do. On the rules side, we need a budget system that actually accounts for the modern entitlement state and has rules in place to make sure that we can't promise away our children's future and our grandchildren's future and stop our ability to educate kids, do research, and defend ourselves.
There has been some concern that your whole thesis about government has actually been tarnished by the recently discredited research of Harvard economists Reinhardt and Rogoff. We actually have an email on that from Mary in the Woodlands, Texas, who says the austerity argument put forth by Reinhardt and Rogar has been discredited in 2013, but I do not hear anyone who propagated this falsehood since 2010 retract their destructive, cruel austerity measures, including Glenn Hubbard, because he is still talking to you right now at the end of May 2013 about cutting entitlements and the debt.
Well, it's a great question, and it's important to understand what Reinhardt and Rogoff said and how it's different from certainly my argument, I think many others. They had argued for a tipping point in government debt past which economy slumped. I've never believed that to be the case, even before their result was questioned. It's undeniably the case that as you increase debt, now I'm going to speak only of arithmetic. One doesn't even need economics to get to this point. Increasing debt will require some other offsetting cuts in spending. That's the defense, research, et cetera, cuts. Or raising taxes. That's math. That doesn't even require economics or sophisticated calculations. The austerity that I talk about in the book is not here and now. Indeed, I blame politicians in this country and in Europe for too much here and now austerity. What we need to focus on is something that gradually brings future debt under control. And that's why the listener's question is so important, because that's the political rub. It's easier to hurt people today politically than to do the right thing of gradual future adjustments because the entitlement programs are so politically popular. It's a critical point.
But the entitlement programs like Medicare, like Social Security, which have been in place for decades, have their own surplus. Certainly Social Security does, and has been on the books, has been transparent, has been flush. But the U.S. government, in its overspending, has had to borrow from that Social Security Trust to meet its own agenda. Why is Social Security always at the center when people talk about austerity?
Well, Medicare is certainly a bigger long-term problem than Social Security. Social Security is actually relatively easy to fix. Gradual adjustments to reduce benefit growth for upper-income Americans can completely fix Social Security's problems. This is not hard. Medicare reform is more complicated because of health care reform dynamics. But you're absolutely right that we played budget games with Social Security for a very long time. This is part of the process problem I'm talking about, and you're hitting on something very important. And we shouldn't do this to the American people. People really understood or thought they understood they were building up surpluses that they weren't.
So the surpluses are still there, are they not? And will remain there for at least 30 years.
Well, unfortunately, there isn't a lockbox or something that locks up surpluses. You're right as a matter of accounting, but it's simply spent. We need to move to a system that if we're going to have entitlement programs structured in this way, that we do safeguard those funds for the purpose for which they're intended.
Now, there's been a great deal of criticism about Europe and its austerity measures. And aren't you talking about the same kind of austerity, which would fall on the American people, as opposed to really taking the toll where it ought to take the toll at the high income level?
Well, actually, not at all. I mean, I've been very critical of current European austerity measures. I think they impose way too much short-term pain simply because the politics of challenging the long-term problems. And by the way, when we talk about entitlement problems in the U.S., they're much larger in many European countries. And so, because we lack the political courage to do the right thing in the long term, yes, we have way too much hair shirt austerity. And there should be no doubt that the bulk of the austerity needs to be borne by the most well-off among us.
What would you do about defense spending?
Well, again, I'm not a military expert. I can observe that relative to GDP, defense spending has declined over decades and is projected to continue to do so. The issue for the defense budget is, you know, are we getting the right bang for our defense buck? It's not by any means clear that we are. My only point in the book is that we can't kid ourselves that cutting defense is the way out of this problem. You could cut the defense budget by a third relative to GDP, and that wouldn't even equal the rounding error on the entitlement share of GDP.
All right. I'm going to open the phones now. We'll go first to Brandenburg, Kentucky. Good morning, Ron. You're on the air.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Well, didn't catch exactly when you started the program, but I appreciate your guest subject of balance. But I think he's insincere on that balance. What I caught when I first tuned in was that military is not where the money is. Now, let me preface this with, I have just retired from the military. My wife is still active duty. I have a daughter in the reserve, Army Reserve, and a son-in-law in the Army. I love our military. But we have to be honest. We had a $300 billion debt defense budget before 9/11, and now it's over $700 billion.
Sir, I'm afraid you're cutting out on us. Your point to Mr. Hubbard is what?
We spend more than the rest of the world combined on military.
All right. Glenn Hubbard, do you want to respond?
Sure. Again, it's a great question. Follows the one you asked. I'm sure that there are inefficiencies in the defense budget, as there are in any budget. What I would warn us is an easy answer that says, oh, defense, we can just cut that and we're done. Again, you could cut the defense budget by a third. You could cut it by half, and you're barely at rounding error on the entitlement programs. So, unfortunately, while there may be a lot of waste in the defense budget, that's not the key to the solution.
All right. Let's go to Julie in Englewood, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I just love your show. Thank you for presenting a lot of thoughtful ideas that other outlets don't.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
My question has to do with just even calling Social Security and Medicare. Why are they considered an entitlement program? I have paid into both of these programs since I was 15 years old. I'm now 57 and have not had to take advantage of them, but I'm frankly afraid about whether it's going to be there. But I'm just wondering why they're always called entitlements if working people are paying into them.
All right. Thanks for your call, Glenn Hubbard.
You ask a great question, and it's actually an extremely important one in this entire debate. They're often called entitlements because people have a right to them, precisely for the reasons that you have suggested. The problem is, in Medicare in particular, a typical household will pay in only about a third of what it will collect. That's not a system that's sustainable. So we need to reform these systems so that we provide substantial aid, I would argue even stronger aid, to people who really need it, and slow down the benefit growth for others.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I presume, however, Glenn Hubbard, that you do appreciate the derisive quality inherent in calling them entitlements, which some people have done, sort of undercutting the fact that, as our caller pointed out, she has paid into them since she was 15 years old. She doesn't think of them in that way. She thinks of them as something she has earned from her working life.
I agree, and this is why this budget discussion needs to be more honest with the American people. Because I think if people understood that, in fact, they're only paying a fraction of the cost of these programs, it would lend a different gloss. And we need to really help a lot more people than we're currently helping by helping a little bit less some more affluent people who don't really need it.
So where would the cutoff be in your own mind?
Well, you know, that's a political question. Depends on how much money you want to spend. But we could save enormous amounts of money even by phasing down benefit growth for people who are in the top 1 or 5% of the income distribution. It strikes me as unusual that we want to give the same subsidies to very affluent people rather than strengthening these programs for people who really need them.
All right. To Houston, Texas. Andre, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question. Grover Norquist thinks dogmatically that cutting taxes is definitely off the table. You've addressed that.
No, you mean raising taxes, sir.
I'm sorry. Yeah, raising taxes.
Yeah.
I apologize.
That's all right.
I think he's missing the point. I think bringing in revenue is an all right thing. What's the opinion on how we spend the money? Not necessarily what we spend the money on, but how we spend the money. I was in the military, and I saw a lot of inefficiencies in how we spend the money. And I think if we were more efficient on where we put the money, people would be a lot more happy with what the government can offer.
All right. Thanks for your call. Yeah. First on Grover Norquist.
Well, it's absolutely the case that if we want to have a larger government, we have to pay for that government. And that means raising more revenue, and that means raising taxes. And there are a variety of ways to do that in ways that aren't so harmful to economic growth. Personally, I'd like to see a smaller long-term government and a smaller tax burden, but that's a political choice. The honest thing is, though, once people make the choice, we have to pay for it. On efficiencies, of course there are efficiencies in government, as there are in any aspect of life, and we need to focus on better management in government. I would just caution that even if we were as efficient as possible in every activity, the budget problem isn't going away. Its source really isn't the classic waste, fraud, and abuse.
But, you know, it's hard to ignore someone like Grover Norquist and his effect on the politics of taxation, the politics of the conversation going on between or among Republicans and Democrats. It's as though they say, the Republicans say, they've signed a pledge, which they will not break. Now, how does that affect political discussion, the ability to reach compromise and find those avenues of discourse that lead to transparency?
It's a great question, because the problem is on both sides, we have one side that says, well, we just like to cut taxes, and another side says, we just won't cut any spending. So if we allow the political equilibrium in that world, that's debt.
Glenn Hubbard, his new book is titled Balance. More of your calls, your comments, when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron Chair, including the True Black Color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. This is NPR.
Hey, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
If we were meeting for the first time today on a train, would you find me attractive?
Of course.
Before Midnight is the third film following the relationship of two lovers who met on a train in Vienna in the 1995 film Before Sunrise. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director, Richard Linklater, and the stars Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke. Join us.
And we're back talking with Glenn Hubbard. He's dean of Columbia University's School of Business, former chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisors under George W. Bush. Here's an email from Jerry in Kalamazoo, Michigan, who says your guest is making an old argument. When he talks about social programs, he talks about horrendous growth in real dollars. When he talks about the defense budget, he talks about the fact that it's actually going down when compared to GDP. Does he not see the dishonesty in that?
Well, I have to break it to our listener that these programs are escalating radically as a share of GDP. In 1970, healthcare spending and entitlements was about 1% of GDP, grew to about six times that a year or so ago. And healthcare and Social Security entitlement spending are projected to grow by 10 percentage points of GDP over the next 25 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office. It really is the problem as a share of GDP.
And what about defense spending? Can you make the same comparisons?
Defense spending is about 3% of GDP, having fallen a lot in recent decades and heading down further.
So you don't see any comparable growth in defense spending despite the off-budget wars we've just fought?
No, again, defense spending may be too high. That's a political question or a military question, but it's nowhere close as a share to GDP, not only to the entitlements today, but especially what they're projected to be 20 or 25 years from now.
All right, let's go to Rockford, Illinois. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Find this to be a very interesting conversation. And what concerns me, besides some of the other comments that have already been voiced this morning, is the inequality of economy growth in this country. And by that, I mean where the money really lies. NPR, within the last year and a half, 2 years, has reported that 3% of the population of this country holds 97% of the wealth. You have CEOs who earn 200% more than their workers, and actually workers, the average American, has lost 4% a year since the 70s. Thereby, there's a decrease in tax revenue. I think this is part of the problem that needs to be addressed. You know, if we're talking about transparency, let's have true transparency, and, you know, let's have everyone share the load.
All right, Glenn Hubbard.
I couldn't agree more with the listener's observation. We have got to do more in government to strengthen and empower people's ability to succeed in the labor market. And that means more spending on education and training. That means more support. And it does mean asking the most well-off among us to make more sacrifices. To my mind, that's best done through the entitlement programs, but that's a political question.
But
I couldn't agree more with the listener.
Why is it done through only the entitlement programs? Why wouldn't it be done on the taxation side, not the entitlement side? You're stressing that upper-income people should receive less on the entitlement side, but that's not going to even out, as our caller said, 3% of the population owning 97% of the wealth.
The most progressive tax system among any industrial country is already the United States. And if we continue to raise marginal tax rates on business income and business owners, we're not going to have a very good recipe for economic growth. We're better off doing this on the spending side. The secret that people aren't telling the American people is if you want the government that we currently have, we would have to raise taxes on all Americans. European countries with big governments pay for them with a value-added tax, a broad-based consumption tax paid more by middle-income people.
But how can you really simply do away with spending on the upper income level with entitlements and achieve the kind of balance that you say you're looking for? The business side, the corporate side, Mr. Hubbard, has gained trillions of dollars. The banks are sitting on trillions of dollars of wealth, not spending, not lending, not doing anything with that wealth, and certainly not creating the kinds of jobs you're talking about. And yet you still don't want to see taxes raised on corporations or those at the top of the income level. It doesn't make sense.
Well, it's also not what I said. The reason businesses and banks are sitting on a lot of money is not because they don't want to invest. I've never met a banker or business leader who wouldn't love to invest, to grow, to hire, to make profits. But the situation in the world economy, the regulation and tax policy affecting businesses is leading them to be quite uncertain. We do need to pay for the government that we have. And the question is, what size is that government and how are we going to pay for it? European countries with big governments do not pay for them with high corporate taxes. Corporate taxes are actually lower in Europe than in the United States.
You know,
they pay for them with consumption taxes.
I have heard that argument about uncertainty for at least 3 years. Uncertainty is always the case with business. It seems that that uncertainty card is being brought out with much greater frequency and force these days, almost as an excuse rather than as a legitimate reason.
Well, I have to be frank, as an economist, I don't see it that way. I've never met a business leader that wouldn't love to invest, simply because they make money by doing that. It's not out of any grace or act of charity. But there is a lot of uncertainty in the economic environment, an awful lot of policy uncertainty. Frankly, both of those are getting better, and I expect the situation to get much better. Your question raises an extremely important point, which is this discussion needs to be about growth. What would it take to keep America's position as not only the biggest economy, but the fastest growing economy?
Give us some of the historical perspective that you use in the book to demonstrate how some empires have fallen because of their wrong-headed approach.
It's a great question. Often empires fall because they don't understand that economic power comes from innovation, from entrepreneurship, from ideas. Rome looked inward at a time when it could least afford it, trying to define people away from being Roman, debased its currency, borrowed from its future, and fell. In the case of the Ming China, the Ming Chinese explorers had been the envy of the world. Every kid learns in school of the seven great voyages of Cheng Ho. That's a staple. And yet future leaders turned inward saying, no, that threatens the status quo. We don't like that innovation. We don't like that imagination. And China, the great power at the time, then stumbles. The Ottoman Empire was not always the basket case we were taught in our school history books. It was once a very strong and important power, but fell internally from rent seeking, from people trying to avoid the development of new technologies. If you fast forward to the British Empire as well, while overstretch is often a thesis for Britain's ultimate decline, and is certainly a factor, Britain tried to be too narrow in its definition of Britishness. We all know that here in this country, we fought a revolution over that very point. By not being very inclusive, by looking inward, Britain avoids capitalizing on its greatest advantage. Japan is another terrific example we use in the book. We use the metaphor of the game of Go, where at the beginning, anything is possible. The end, not so much. And in the middle is where all the action is. Japan's been in that middle quite a while, and it had a big pop in growth after the Second World War. But then by looking inward, by not advantaging innovation and entrepreneurship, it stumbled. California is a case study we use in the book, as you mentioned earlier. It's the only big landmass in the world that has the beautiful climate of the Mediterranean that's not also in the Mediterranean. The problem is California has something else the Mediterranean has, which is dysfunctional politics. California is a rich state. It doesn't have long-term problems if it gets its act together. And we close, of course, with the United States itself, that we currently are on this precipice because of where we are in our budget process and our political system. But both Tim Kaine, my co-author, and I are very optimistic this country can work it out. And 25 years from now, we're still on top.
All right, let's go back to the phones to Creekside, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you.
Certainly.
My comment is related, to transparency, but I would call it clarity. With one of the callers that called in a little while ago and said, why do we call it an entitlement when I've worked for it? I think that Dr. Hubbard, you might have missed what she was saying in a sense, because somehow the word entitlement, which in its pure dictionary definition is neutral, has picked up a pejorative sense. So I think what she was saying is, why is this looked at as some sort of welfare gift that I don't deserve? And so I think part of the problem is maybe it's that word entitlement has run its course.
I couldn't agree more with that observation. It is the case that these programs, Social Security and Medicare, are incredibly important. And frankly, we need to make them stronger. The problem is, on their current path, we can't do that. We can make a program that's more focused on people who need it really strong, But if we wanted to pay for the programs on the path they're on now, we couldn't do anything else.
Gwen does. Go ahead.
Oh, I agree with you, Dr. Hubbard. What I'm saying, though, is that the language is making us talk at cross purposes. I think that word it's got so much baggage now. It's almost like saying socialism or communism. All rational thought stops. So we can't talk about transparency because we have grudges associated with those words.
I think that's an interesting point.
That's a very good point.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for your call, Gwen. Let's go to Edgewater, Maryland. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
Go right ahead, sir.
Mr. Hubbard just mentioned being on the precipice, and I guess that's related to our debt. But all I've heard with regard to the inappropriateness of our debt is related to our income, where I think most people who make lending decisions are less interested in income than they are in wealth. And I think when you compare the United States culture's wealth to its debt, I believe the wealth is in the $75 to $100 trillion range, you know, then the debt becomes much less significant. I mean, if when you're making a decision to borrow money for a mortgage, you know, you aren't just looking at your income, you're looking at your wealth.
Of course. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Do you want to respond to that?
Sure, just quickly. The caller is absolutely right. Wealth is a very important metric. The caution I would have is that the Congressional Budget Office's estimates of the unfunded liabilities of Social Security and Medicare, that is over and above the tax revenues that are about to be collected to pay for them, is well over $70 trillion.
All right. And to a caller here in Washington, D.C., Andreas, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I just finished an MBA program and founded my own company. And so I'm interested in what Mr. Hubbard, as the dean of a business school, has to say about the belief I have that business should be taking a leadership role in helping to reduce dependence on entitlement and correct the problem that an earlier caller mentioned about, you know, a 200% disparity between CEOs and workers. How is Dean Hubbard at Columbia teaching future business leaders to work on increasing pay and increasing benefits and run a profitable business by doing that in order to help reduce employees' dependence on entitlement?
Thanks for your call.
And thank you for that question. There was a time in this country's history, not even too many decades ago, where being a business leader meant more than just being a successful head of a company. It meant solving big social and policy problems. You know, the Marshall Plan didn't come about because of a wise Congress. It came about because the American business community led a reluctant Congress. We need to do this again today. We need to think much harder about what kind of health care system could be delivered at lower cost so that people can take home more pay. We need to figure out how to support education and training more to support the kind of jobs we want in this country. And business can't simply say, oh, we'll let government figure that out. We need to have business organizations like the Business Roundtable, the Committee for Economic Development, groups of CEOs and business leaders. This needs to be their problem. No business person should just say, ah, that's the government's.
What about focusing on infrastructure? We've just seen a bridge collapse a few years back. Another bridge collapse in Minneapolis. Roads are in need of repair. Isn't that a way of boosting the economy, boosting economic growth, and at the same time providing the needed jobs? Surely there's no uncertainty there.
Infrastructure is extremely important. I would start with energy, which is one of the great optimistic hopes for the United States. North America could be energy independent in 20 years if we allowed the construction boom to finance it. We also have the ability to build more public infrastructure. The only caution I would have is that's not really stimulus. It can't happen immediately, but you're absolutely right. For the long term, it is what government should be doing.
Glenn Hubbard, with his co-author, Tim Kaine, they've written a new book titled balance the economics of great powers from ancient Rome to modern America. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Casey Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, and Daniel Knight. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yerv-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from